This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Dust off your boots and polish up your two-step. Beyonce is going deep into country with her upcoming album, Cowboy Carter. Despite what some fans believe, black women have been making country music for decades, and this could be their renaissance moment.
A lot of people are shocked to know that the banjo is an African instrument with African origins. We're like not just an influence, we're a key part of that music.
Beyonce and the history of black women in country music coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Just months after wrapping her Renaissance tour, which earned $500 million worldwide, Beyonce is rocking the music world again. This time, she's taking a two-step into country music. Her new country album, Cowboy Carter, is set for release at the end of this month. Her song, Texas Hold'em, made history as the first by a black woman to top the country charts. And influencers, TikTokers, and maybe even your mom are line dancing to the hit all across social media.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay our cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus. Ooh. And throw your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round. Stick around.
This isn't Beyonce's first rodeo. Her 2016 album Lemonade featured the country song Daddy Lessons. And B is not the only black woman bringing new fans to the genre. This year, Tracy Chapman became the first black woman to win an award for the Country Music Association after singer Luke Combs covered her 1988 song, Fast Car. But black women have always made country music, and many of the singers who became R&B, folk, or rock and roll stars have country roots. Joining us now to talk about it all is Francesca Royster. She's a professor at DePaul University and author of the book, Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. Francesca Royster, welcome to A Word.
Thank you, Jason. I'm so excited to be here.
As a scholar of country music, what did you think when you first heard Texas Hold'em?
My first reaction was wow, because to me, I could hear the continuation of Renaissance. I could hear this as a dance song, and it's, you know, just making that claim that we dominate dance music. You know, we are part of all kinds of music. And so the bridge between house music and the storytelling and beats of Texas Hold'em to me feel really close. And that's not, you know, as someone who maybe might not have been listening to country music or expecting that Beyonce would be making a country music song, like to people for whom this is a surprise, that might not have been the first impression. But because I'd already heard the rumors that Beyonce was going to make a country music album, that she has been showing up at rodeos and she made Daddy Lessons, the appearance of the song wasn't as much a surprise to me. I mean, she did come in on a horse on the cover of Renaissance, and cowboy iconography is so much a part of that. So I was hearing it. I was excited to finally hear what she had to say, but I was also really thinking about her past album and really thinking, wow, all right, she's really trying to expand our sense of what Black music is, as have many, many artists, but Beyonce has her own way of doing that.
Back in 2016, she released Daddy Lessons and even performed it with the Chicks, or most of us Gen Xers remember them as the Dixie Chicks at one point. They dropped the name, they dropped the Dixie part. At the CMA Awards ceremony, here's a clip. With his gun, with his head held high, he told me not to cry. Oh, my daddy said shoot. Oh, my daddy said shoot. With his right hand on his rifle, he swore. After this performance, there was a tremendous amount of hostility in country music circles. Remind us, for someone who actually studies this genre, what was that moment like? And what was it about that performance that got a certain kind of country music fan so up in their stirrups?
Well, you know, it was a pretty nervy performance because she, it's not the first time on CMAs that Black artists have come to perform. LL Cool J kind of famously has been a part of it, and others as well. But this was the first time that the Chicks or Dixie Chicks had returned to the CMA space or to public country music spaces since they were more or less pressured to put their careers on hold after they made their critique of George Bush back in the earlier 2000s. So for Beyoncé, already kind of an outsider, to appear with the Chicks was already like throwing down the cowboy hat. So I think that that's also really cool because of the ways that the Chicks have been so outspoken about the war, but also about domestic violence and, you know, other really, really important causes that Beyoncé is also a part of. So I think that that was part of it. I definitely do think that, you know, being just a few days before the election, that CMA performance was at a point where the bifurcation of our culture along lines of race, supposedly in the name of class, was, you know, at a fever pitch. So public discourse was pretty high. And country music has often been a place where some folks who are, let's say, white supremacists have kind of embraced the music, as their safe place, you know, in a sea of change. But that doesn't really reflect the reality of the genre because there's always been more than that going on. So I think between the Chicks controversy, the general climate, and then Beyoncé herself as someone who has been outspoken in critiques of the police about police violence and supportive of Black Lives Matter, who, you know, has also kind of taken militant iconography, like in her Super Bowl performance. I think that people who were disposed to see her critically were really having a field day. And, you know, and the conversation was that she was this outsider. Who was she? What nerve did she have to make this song and record it? And then the song itself is so great because it is bringing together all these different sounds, country music for sure, second line, brass band, jazz, all kinds of stuff, hip hop, of course, all together and kind of making a claim, you know, claiming space on country at the Country Music Association stage.
This is interesting to me because, you know, earlier this week, Dolly Parton publicly blessed Beyoncé's plan to cover her legendary song, Jolene. Does that really end up making a difference, this idea of being blessed for a genre? I mean, like, if you're predisposed to not like Beyoncé, if you're predisposed to not like Black people in this kind of music, I don't see if it makes a difference. Do you think that's going to make a difference for the consumer, or is it really just sort of for amongst musicians that it was a real honor for Dolly to say, hey, you know, I respect Beyoncé as an entertainer?
I do think that the Beyoncé's blessing has become kind of an important gesture of inclusion, that Dolly herself has been kind of a public face for lefty or more progressive country music. So what I saw that blessing as is like a kind of rallying cry in a way for country music fans who don't believe the hype, who are leaning toward more progressive issues, and also kind of also an older generation of country music artists. But Dolly's fans include folks of multiple generations. So I don't think that having her blessing is going to change the minds of, you know, someone like John Schneider or Jason Aldean or some of the other more conservative voices that have come to the fore in criticism of the album. But it is, I think, a kind of gathering of like-minded people that maybe people who don't listen to Beyoncé, which it's hard for me to imagine there are people who don't, but I think that there are, you know, and to think, okay, yeah, this is a way that you can be part of cultural change. And she has Dolly's blessing. So I do think it's important in the same way that Dolly also gave her approval to Lil Nas X when Lil Nas X covered Jolene and, you know, posed on social media and, you know, in general, gave her blessing for that cover. So I think it's important in a larger way.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on Beyoncé and the history of Black women in country music. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. I've got a special message for our listeners in Canada. It's about a show that I think you should listen to, Canada Land. Every week, Canada Land's journalists bring you news and conversations that honestly can be hard to find these days. With rigorous reporting and thoughtful analysis, their episodes bring you into the most important conversations from across the country. From a radical form of reconciliation emerging in Saskatchewan, to in-depth debates and gun rights and the rise of fascism, Canada Land's stories will surprise you and make you think. Try Canada Land today and find out why Canadian news doesn't have to sound like Canadian news. Search Canada Land in your podcast app.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
This is Jason Johnson, host of A Word, Slate's podcast about race and politics and everything else. I want to take a moment to welcome our new listeners. If you've discovered A Word and like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And let us know what you think by writing us at aword@slate.com. Thank you. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about Beyoncé and Black women in country music. Our guest is Professor Francesca Royster, author of Black Country Music. So, Francesca, I'm just going to get to the core of this. How much of this is really just about white folks saying country music is theirs and they don't like Black people being involved? Because to me, that's what this sounds like. As somebody who is an outsider to the Bay Hive, as somebody who is an outsider to country music, this just sounds like white folks being mad.
I do think that these kinds of questions, you know, what are the boundaries of the genre, are important to the way that the genre has functioned. And some of that, you know, for decades, really since it was created as a market in the 1920s and 30s, this idea that this is country music. Country music which was called Hillbilly Music at that time, was slated as being for white audiences and, you know, as reflecting the art of white people, even though that wasn't true, even though country music's roots are multiple, including African-American, Mexican and Mexican-American, as diverse really as the United States is, but especially the blues and especially black string band traditions and especially rancheros and Mexican music. Those are really strong forces. So the idea of kind of drawing the line and really using country music to reflect the segregation of Jim Crow is something that's been a part of country music's genre, you know, from its very beginnings. Like, this is the music, these are the people that we're going to reach. I think with that, the music has been used politically for white supremacist or white nationalist groups to kind of rally around. And that was also supported by the ways that, you know, blackface was a tradition in live country music performances as recently, I guess, as the 1950s and 60s. Live country music performances like the National Barn Dance, which was broadcast here in Chicago, used blackface performers, you know, sometimes, you know, in between the songs. So there's a way that country music is connected to nostalgia about a white supremacist past that continues to be evoked, and that nostalgia is reinforced by sidelining, caricaturing creative influence. So with a history like that, I think that that's really shaping the moment that we're in now, where even though there's been an outpouring of Black creativity in terms of country music for the past, for several decades, thinking about Linda Martell's music, along with Charlie Pride's music in the late 1960s. And, you know, going back forward, Tina Turner made a country music album in the early 1970s. Tina Turns the Country On. Millie Jackson, you know, wonderful soul songstress and diva, made two country music albums. And there are more recent country music artists like Mickey Guyton and Rissy Palmer, Brittany Spencer, who've been, you know, Allison Russell, who've been making this really rich music. Beyonce included the music of Rhiannon Giddens on Texas Hold'em. And that's really reflective not only of the fact that Rhiannon Giddens is a go-to for the banjo sound and banjo history, Black banjo traditions, but also that she's been making music that's country / Americana for at least two decades, solo and with the Carolina Chocolate Drops. So there's been a lot of ways that the segregation of country music has been with us, you know, from its beginnings as a genre, but also there have been a lot of really creative artists working in the mainstream and also working on the edges of the mainstream to bring back Black imagination and Black creativity to the sound.
This speaks to something that I'm really curious about. So a lot of times we talk about cultural appropriation. We talk about taking the music, the clothing, the food of another culture of people and not acknowledging that's where it's from. So if you literally had country music acts having people in blackface up until performances in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, were white country music artists, were they always aware that they were stealing Black music? Or was that sort of hey, we do blackface anyway, and this is what we're going to add to it? Like, did people know they were culturally appropriating blues country music that Black people have been creating for, you know, 50 or 60 years prior?
I don't know if audiences always knew, because I do believe that the importance of blackface as, like, probably the first major commercial form of popular music, that that's a history that people just don't want to think about and maybe don't know. But, you know, from the 19th century on, the first music, sheet music, and then recorded music and performed music that made money for people was blackface. So, you know, its influence on all kinds of genres is really unignorable. And my friend Matthew Morrison has just written a book where he's talking about the ways that copyright laws around popular music are really shaped by what went down during blackface and eventually vaudeville, where the black artists weren't given copyright control over the music that they had been performing in the past, and white blackface artists also got control of particular folk songs and other songs through copyright. And so there's a way that black creativity and influence was already sidelined. And then I think that there's kind of this, also the way that, you know, ideology works is to make things seem natural, that the logic of, you know, segregation and capitalism and racism gets naturalized when it's connected to bodies. So there's kind of this idea that it's white bodies that make this sound. White bodies have the twang. You know, country music is about white rural lives. It's like the myth that it, you know, comes only from these isolated communities in Appalachia where white, pure Anglo-Saxon white people live, and they've been perpetuating this music. So there's a way that country music has used these ideologies that kind of naturalize its segregation and erase black people. So I think that because it worked so well, I do think that a lot of people are shocked to know that the banjo is an African instrument with African origins. And the sounds that we hear in like bluegrass are sounds that were really developed in part by the influence of like blues women like Elizabeth Cotton and Etta Baker, like, you know, in the Piedmont region of North Carolina. Like those picking styles are styles that are also part of black musical traditions. Definitely, you know, like other people were also originating and creating things, but we were like not just an influence, we were a key part of that music. But I think that like really the way that ideology works so well is that it makes things seem natural, which are actually political arguments. And the way that it works to convince people that it's like a natural, inescapable fact is by connecting it to bodies and to the visuals of racism, and maybe also the morality of racism.
What would you say was the turning point culturally? Because it's a very brilliant idea. It's, yeah, you know, ideology sort of makes these things seem natural. What was the turning point for country with mostly black audiences? Because I know that a lot of older black folks, grandparents' age, et cetera, they listened to country because that was blues. This is pretty much the same sort of thing for them, right? The Muddy Waters and all those kinds of people. But I'm a Gen Xer. Like, country music was white people music when I was growing up. In fact, like, we were considering Garth Brooks a crossover because they would play Friends in Low Places at roller skating rink, right? I mean, that's just my own cultural ignorance. So what was that point? What was that point where black people sort of turned on country, or at least fell for the banana in the tailpipe from the white folks, that country was never ours?
Well, I think, you know, this might be too recent for the argument, but I do think that Lil Nas X's Old Town Road was a really important point of kind of facing that segregation and questioning it for black folks, because there was such an outcry against the music. And what, you know, Lil Nas X was doing something that a lot of hip hop artists were doing, which was like creating his own sound based on samples and other things that he found on the internet, you know, making the music in his grandma's guest room, putting it out on social media, making his own like Reddit searches, you know, and just really working the internet and working technology without the allegiance of country music radio or record labels. And it made people so mad. So I think it made radio stations angry. It made fans angry. And eventually it also, I think, kind of alienated, you know, institutions like Billboard, which question the sound of the music, which I think is kind of ridiculous when you think about the role of hip hop in current country music right now. So I think that the public conversation around Lil Nas X and his own like humor in handling the critiques, I think let a lot of people in and really brought to the fore that this is, you know, the ability to move within genres is really tightly controlled. I think it gave us all a chance to see how gatekeeping has worked quietly, you know, for decades. And now, like, this new inventive young artist is really feeling the heat of that in a way that's right in the public. So I do feel like that controversy also made Black country music artists work together and collaborate in a way. It also brought in allies like Jason Isbell or Maren Morris or Randy Carlisle, people who were progressive white country music artists, to say, hey, this is a topic that I need to go to bat for. And so it did change the conversation. But, you know, we have had other big moments in terms of Black country music at different times. Like, I see Mickey Guyton's song, Black Like Me, which really important in terms of a kind of country music reckoning of racism, or Charlie Pride's success in the 70s. Like, Charlie Pride for a long time was the only Black artist that a lot of people could come up with as a name of a Black musician in country music who's really making it, you know, really succeeding in mainstream terms. So yeah, Little Nas X for me. Maybe now Luke Combs and Tracy Chapman, like right before this Beyonce controversy, was another point where all of us, including Black folks, were thinking, wait, this has been going on for a long time. And now we're at that moment again.
Obviously, there is gatekeeping going on, whether it's who owns record labels or just local people deciding who they will and will not play on your country music station. How is sort of gatekeeping in country music different for Black women artists versus Black male artists? Because I've heard of a lot more Black male artists. I mean, you got Darius Rucker, who was, you know, Hootie and, I mean, that was frat rock, right? And he went from frat rock to being an absolutely respected, you know, Darius Rucker can go anywhere. Right. You know, in some very, 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 very white exclusive places. So how's the gatekeeping different for Black men country artists than women?
I do think, you know, I think that Black men obviously have also experienced gatekeeping, but I do think that there's a gender dynamic of it for sure. There's a way that Darius Rucker in his persona is one that is like familiar, like the Black best friend. Like, there's a way that he has been, you know, allowed to kind of continue to make music within country music because he's avoided hot topics like sexism and racism for the most part. Although he has stepped out and talked about George Floyd's murder, for example. You know, and someone also like Charlie Pride, you know, back in the 70s was also like very amiable and very much, you know, best friend of Willie Nelson, able to go on Hee Haw and have like a banjo duet with Roy Clark. Like, he is someone who was really good at making people feel safe. And I think, you know, even his voice, like, there's kind of this idea that his voice was very white friendly or white sounding. And I think Black women have been gatekept in part because, you know, even in a stronger way, because I think they have less institutional power overall, but also the ways that, you know, patrolling their sexuality has been and their gender presentation has been a part of the gatekeeping as well as racism. And, you know, just thinking about a story that Rissy Palmer told about being critiqued for wearing natural hair when she was getting ready to make a music video for her Country Girl song back in the early 2000s. So I do think that that's part of what's going on. But I have noticed that, and this is maybe connected to kind of a Black feminist sensibility for some artists, that there's been a lot of collaboration and a lot of ways that Black women have teamed up together to make their music or to perform on stage together, you know, thinking about Our Native Daughters or thinking about when Mickey Guyton was invited to the CMAs, she invited other Black country artists like Madeline Edwards and Brittany Spencer to perform with her. So I think there's a kind of interesting strategy that I see more Black women doing in the industry than Black men, which is to team up together and, you know, to make that hive, you know, the power of the hive.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more about Black women in country music. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about Beyoncé and Black women's place in country music with Professor Francesca Royster. She's the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. We mentioned earlier, we've talked about this, we've referenced it several times, that Tracy Chapman won a CMA Songwriting Award for Fast Car. And she and Luke Combs brought a lot of folks to tears with their duet at the Grammys. Here's a clip.
I remember when you were driving in your car. Speed so fast, it felt like I was gone. City lights way out before. Rockin' lights down around my shore. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone. Be someone, be someone.
This was a huge one, and it was recent. What I found, a lot of the conversation around it after that performance is so many writers, so many, in particular, Black woman cultural critics that I respect, that I follow, were like, Luke Combs' level of reverence towards Tracy Chapman was so obvious. Like, people were moved by the fact that this man was on that stage and was like, I cannot believe I am here with her. And because Tracy Chapman, you know, is the kind of artist she is. She was never a sex symbol. She was never a pop culture star. She was very much like, I'm an artist, I make my music, then I disappear. Talk a little bit about that moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he did that Wayne's World, We Are Not Worthy bow toward her at the end of that performance. And I think that some of it is that, you know, speaking for myself, like, many of us have been so hungry to see Tracy Chapman, you know, and to see her perform. And to see her apparent joy in that performance, that she seemed at ease, you know, as someone who is rumored to be very shy. And yeah, like, how many public moments do we get to see a white man, like, showing that kind of respect and reverence for an African-American woman? And I think that, you know, the points where they were trading verses was really poignant, because it was clear. Well, first of all, because Tracy Chapman's voice is just so amazing and personally, like, just so distinctive. I don't want to compare, because I think there's room for everyone. But, you know, he really was willing to share the stage. And even though that shouldn't be a rare gesture, it is. So, and then to see Chapman after she walked away, more or less, from her career. The public part of her career, you know, a decade ago, I think, many, especially as Fast Car, you know, was getting airplay through Luke Combs' cover, there was just this hunger to see, all right, like, we want to see Tracy, like, we really want to see her get her flowers. We really want to see her doing the thing that is unique about her version of it. And it's not at all that her own version of Fast Car didn't get plenty of accolades in its own time. And Chapman has won, I think, like, 3 or 4 Grammys. You know, so she isn't this obscure person that has been, you know, pulled from the heaps of history. But she is someone who, I think, in this moment, it's just great to see her kind of getting her respect. So I think that that's really important. And I was really thinking a lot about also, you know, someone like Stacey Abrams or other Black women who have been on the line politically and really taking a lot of heat in terms of politics, and how, you know, this is a moment, a national moment, where instead of the scapegoating of a Black woman who's strong, we see her getting this homage, you know, getting respect.
We've been talking a lot about Beyoncé, her influence on music, other Black folks' influence on music, and white folks trying to gatekeep. And we've seen that sort of happen back and forth, right? You saw in the early 90s that you had, say, hip hop artists who were like, look, this Vanilla Ice guy, we got to be careful, because in 30 years, you know, they'll take over our music. And that didn't happen, right? Eminem was not going to be that guy. But there is some pushback, even from some Black writers, about country music being embraced by Black people. And so it's interesting. You reference a writer in your book, Nikki Finney, a country fan who said, quote, "This is the music we were lynched by. These are the hangman songs." How have you dealt with that sort of association as an academic, or overcome them as a fan? Because again, you know, for a lot of Black folks, country music is dangerous white people lynching us, burning us, you know, chasing us out of town, dragging us behind trucks. How do you fight against that sort of in your writing or as a fan?
Well, really, that those feelings, that discomfort, even fear that I would hear sometimes when I would hear country music was what drew me to the project. I wanted to understand, as someone who spent part of her childhood in the South in Nashville, like, why did I have both this feeling of warmth and connection with some country music artists, but also this like sense of fear, especially in terms of public spaces where country music is being played. So I really wanted to explore it and to get comfortable with just the messiness of the history. And really that was partly acknowledging the fact that, you know, this is a history with blood at the roots. It's not made up. Like, our fears around appropriation and also around, you know, racial violence and music being part of that or using to justify racial violence is not a myth. Like, it's true. So I think about like one of the first early country music stars, Fiddlin' John Carson, who was like the first person to be made into a star for his fiddle playing, was contracted to play at a KKK rally. He wasn't necessarily a KKK member. I don't know if he was, but it was like a totally okay thing to be part of, you know, part of this work. And, you know, the kinds of songs that are also at the roots of country music are songs like songs that sometimes told stories of lynching that were performed at lynchings, like Nikki Finney said. So some of these like really violent stories are part of the music. And yeah, I guess that I am okay with like just acknowledging my own discomfort and trying to write through it. And that's partly what makes me curious and interested in it. At the same time that I've really learned about this really painful history and tried to really face it, I've also met artists and thinkers who are invested in this music and who are trying to tell their own stories through it. And that has made it worth it to me. So, you know, like going to see Our Native Daughters with Rhiannon Giddens, Amethyst Kia, Allison Russell, and Layla McCullough, and seeing them use banjos to talk about music that they wrote in response to enslaved Black women and our histories and the erasure of that history, and kind of, they really were creating counter songs to the kinds of songs that Nikki Finney was talking about. Like seeing that and bringing my daughter, or going to a Black Opera Review performance with like five Black country music up and coming artists and seeing them playing with each other and like we're supporting each other through their music was really heartening. Or talking to Rissy Palmer about her own struggles in the industry. Like, all of those things just gave me hope. And, you know, also meeting scholars who really see, like me, this history as part of a history of understanding racism in America. I think that's just given me room. So I think as a fan, I've never been a casual fan. I've always been kind of let's see what this is about, kind of active, critical fan. And I think that meeting like-minded people and seeing the potential for this music for getting conversations going has been really energizing.
You know, I always wrap up the show and give people an opportunity to sort of engage, like, oh, hey, how can they follow? How can they pay attention? How can they engage? So for this, it's something kind of different. You know, for all the people out there who are TikToking and putting on their country music boots and basically just dusting off their sparkly Renaissance cowboy hats, somebody who's going to listen to Beyonce's new album, they're going to listen to that album, and some of them are going to say, I want more. Asking you right now, what are two Black women country artists that you would 1,000% suggest to people coming off their Beyonce high?
I think they should listen to Linda Martell's Color Me Country album, where you see someone who is telling Black stories about migration with a like clear country music vocabulary. And she's just wonderful. It's her only album. And she, for a long time, has kind of gone unknown. She's still alive and still around. So I definitely recommend her. And I also recommend the music of Brittany Spencer, who is a contemporary up-and-coming country music artist who is also, you know, using the recognizable sonic and storytelling vocabulary of country music to tell stories that are personal and intimate and really powerful.
Francesca Royster is the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolution. She's also a professor of English at DePaul University. Thank you so much for spending time with a country novice and a Beyonce novice like myself.
Thank you, Jason. It's been a great conversation.
And that's a word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. This episode was produced by Christy Taiwo Macanjula. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Slate Audio. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for A Word.